This is art 12, and this closure of the art sequence prepares us for a springboard into the most interesting quarter of the education. The next process that we encounter is the fourth process. We encountered nature, we encountered myth, and we encountered vision. We encountered the ceaseless change of nature. We encountered the mythic ocean of language. We encountered the magic realm of conscious vision. And we were able to navigate across those processes with increasing difficulty. History is the most challenging of all of the processes in reality, and almost no one navigates across it. Just as when you cross nature, you come into existence, you come into the ritual comportment of existence, which is objective, the body. The body not only is a thing, but what the body does. The body is its objectivity in what it's doing. So out of the process of nature, existence precipitates. It rains objectivity. Quarks form, particles form, atoms form, protons and neutrons come together, electrons swirl around them in flashing orbital clouds. The atoms come together and they make molecules. Molecules make stuff. Stuff becomes inorganic materia, which becomes organic with a little COOH radicals added, and you have life. So ritual is an objectivity that comes out of nature. And the objectivity that comes out of the mythic process of language and experience is the mind. So that the body is the objectivity of nature and the mind is the objectivity of mythic language. And we have been talking about how out of the process of vision, out of the magic of consciousness comes the person. We ourselves. I. Our person is objective, and that objectivity emerges out of the magic consciousness of vision. The artist makes out of the magic vision the objective work of art. And the person is very much a work of art. Any human being who becomes who they really are is a work of art. Appreciable on a scale of the best painting of a Rembrandt, the best play of a Shakespeare, the best sculpture of a Michelangelo. A human person is beautiful, sublime, a triumph of objectivity. And so art 12 today, the 12th lecture in art, is all about artistic persons. And we're going to talk about persons in just a moment. But the challenge ahead of us is a definite challenge. Because just as when the body forms itself, it immediately begins in its action to engender experience. And that experience literally is something to talk about. I can remember in the sixth grade, lived along the Gulf Coast of Texas, read Homer for the first time, and got it. Little sixth grade Texas boys building rafts to try and get out of Corpus Christi Harbor into the Caribbean to go have adventures because you wanted to have something to tell, to come back and tell kids that didn't do that, to tell your mother, to tell your father what you had done, what you had found, what you had taken. The whole thing about experience is that you go and do it. You have it. So that you have something to tell. Something to tell about. So that the whole motive for engendering more and better and more interesting experience is that you have something to tell. The whole mythic experience is this process of exploration, and out of that comes an intelligence of feeling. The body learns that it isn't just here, but that it can experience, and in the experiencing, it engenders a sense of intelligence about feeling. And that whole feeling-toned intelligence about experience and language has this penetrative quality. It goes through the body like osmosis and goes inside. And so experience and feeling create an inner world. Not only the objectivity of the body, but the objectivity of the inner world, the inner quality of the body. One begins to become interested in caves underground. One begins to become interested in the way in which little birds or reptiles come out of eggs. One gets interested in wombs and how babies come out of wombs. One gets interested in the hollows of things and how they engender something new. And those interior spaces, the cave within, the egg within, the womb within, become increasingly fascinating, and out of that inner hollow comes a sense of presence. And the mind becomes objective. And with symbols, objectifies itself. And those symbols, very powerful, become seeds out of which whole objective forms like ideas gain existence and gain objectivity that's on an even higher level than the body. Just so, out of vision, out of this magic process, which is quite distinct from nature. Magic, in fact, is the opposite of nature. Nature, where it moves in a clockwise fashion, so that all good rituals are usually in a seasonal clockwise motion. In magic, the reverse. You go the other way. Not to be perverse, that would be a doctrinaire misunderstanding of the process, but to differentiate instead of integrate. Because the clockwise seasonal winding brings things together. It brings particles into atoms, it brings atoms into molecules, molecules into compounds. Species come out of this coming together, integration, the clumping, the making of the objectivity and ever-increasing complexity, but the complexity is not one of openness so much, but it's one of increasing compactness. And this whole process reaches an exclamation mark. The exclamation mark is where the mind finds its center, where presence finds the pivot upon which all integration swirls. And at that unwobbling pivot, that's what Ezra Pound called it. He was making a translation of Confucius in the 1920s. And his friends like W.B. Yeats and T.S. Eliot and James Joyce were writing all these fantastic works, and Pound was having trouble writing his cantos. So he made a translation of Confucius, And he realized that what Confucius was all about was the stillness that's there in the human being. He realized that Confucius was an appreciator of an older contemporary of his, someone who was about two generations older than Confucius, and that individual was Lao Tzu, the founder of Tao in its expression, the Tao Te Ching. And when he was mature, Confucius went to see the old Lao Tzu and came out. And his disciples, his students, asked him, he said, "Well, what did you talk about?" He said, "No one can tell what the dragon is saying. But what can be said is what I'm talking about." And so Confucius wrote a book called the Lun Yu. It's called the Analects in translation. It's about the still center core of the human being, that whatever the mysterious dragon of Tao may be or may not be, its ultimate pivot and balance for us is within us, is at the very core, the pivot of the inner world. And Pound translated Confucius's word for that as the phrase, the unwobbling pivot. This unwobbling pivot becomes the still point, which at every instance is capable of being a turning point in any motion, any dynamic. There was a film made a number of years ago about a ballet company called The Turning Point, that the ballerina must develop the sense of where the still pivot is in order to keep her body in its motion completely in an artistic form. If you cannot tell where the still core is, you cannot make your movement an artistic whole. You will never be able to dance. A ballet is the ultimate expression of an artistic form which centers itself around a shared core of stillness. In a pas de deux, both dancers must share that still core. If they do not share it, they will not make that dance form artistic. It will show up. It won't work. It doesn't look good. The ballet in its shared core comes from a discovery made about 600 years ago, 600-700 years ago, by a Sufi named Rumi. Actually, he's called Malavi in Iran, Jalaluddin Rumi. He founded an order called the Whirling Dervishes, the Mevlevi Dervishes, who found that they could realize a differential open quality, the infinite resonances of their person when they were completely intoxicated, not by alcohol, not by the molecules of plants, but by the motion of endless circling, that the body becomes intoxicated to the point of dizziness by continuous circling, by whirling, by turning, by constantly turning. The body will become dizzy. It will become intoxicated, but the inner core will not. And they found that as you whirl more and more and you firmly position your differential coordinates on the still core, you will never get dizzy. Your body will never get dizzy, because the still core spiritual person is much more powerful as an object than is the body. The body is powerful in nature. It focuses all of nature. But the mind is much more powerful than the body. The body can recast itself in terms of nature, but it is recast in itself by the power of the mind. But the artistic person is much more powerful than the mind. The artist can recast a mind as easily as a body can be reconditioned by a mind. And so in this kind of an order, this kind of a hierarchy, which turns out not to be a stepladder hierarchy at all, because though the mind, one can say, is deeper than the body because it's inside, or the mind is higher than the body because it is above, deeper or higher, one cannot say that about a differential form like the person. The person is not deeper than the mind. It's not that here's the body, and within that is the mind, and within that is the person. Not at all. The person is not limited to the mind whatsoever. The spiritual person is a differential form and is real by virtue of continual, complete openness. The form of the person is one of differential conscious openness and not at all of integration. The rules, the laws, the principles of integration do not affect the spirit at all. They have only a complementary relationship in that the body and the mind obey those laws and those principles, but the person is quite different. So we say that the spiritual self that we are, the artistic reality that we are, the ineffable person that we are, is able to walk through matter, to walk through illusions of the mind. The person is no more constrained by the constraints of mental ideas than they are by the body. The spirit can leave the body quite easily and come back quite easily. Can leave the mind quite easily and come back quite easily. Is not at all constrained. It's as if the body and the mind take form in the electromagnetic spectrum, but that the conscious, artistic, spiritual person takes form not in the electromagnetic spectrum, but in its mathematical converse, its mathematical, logical complement, in the magnetoelectric spectrum. When James Clerk Maxwell was working out the field equations of electromagnetism 140 years ago, he found that you can solve those equations two completely similar ways. They solve positively and they solve negatively. But being a good Victorian Scotsman, he paid no attention to the fact that the equations for electromagnetism solve negatively just as mathematically tight, just as logically consistent, and just as realistic as they do in a positive way. Because all the positive solutions are electromagnetism, and they work very well. But the negative solutions, which are magnetoelectric, solve just as accurately. Only they're on a different order of energy. The magnetoelectric spectrum is about 10 billion times the energy of the electromagnetic spectrum. So that a form in magnetoelectric quality would walk through the electromagnetic universe as if it didn't exist. There's already incredible oceans of space in between the atoms, in between the electrons and the nucleuses of atoms, in between the atoms that make up molecules, even in spaces between molecules. And when you magnify that 10 billion times, There's enough space to put the entire universe in between one electron and one proton. So we never have to touch. Is this metaphysics? Not at all. It's mathematical astrophysics for the magnetoelectric universe, which is a differential energy, a differential dynamic, has differential forms. And so the artistic person belongs to a completely different order from the mind or the body. One can say in all truthfulness that art is on a scale that's unheard of in terms of the tribe, unheard of in terms of the academy. People who achieve existential thusness with their body and live on a tribal level in the mythic horizon have a very difficult time, but can be taught to appreciate people who live on the mental level in universities and academies. One can train one, but it's almost impossible to train someone to be an artist. You cannot teach art. Frank Lloyd Wright said, you can create conditions that are propitious to the experience which leads to art, but you cannot teach art. Because art is not in that integral progression whatsoever. It doesn't belong there whatsoever. And it doesn't belong deeper, it doesn't belong higher. It's that it is a completely open, infinite resonance and doesn't belong. So that an artistic form, like the spiritual person, is of a completely different, though related, quality of objectivity. One asks a very sensible question. If the body and the mind are like a pair, they're like an integral pair, they merge, they go together, they have their vibration together. If the person, if the artist is so completely different, what pairs up with the artist? And the answer is, there's only one form in reality that pairs with the artist, and that's the cosmos as a whole. But the cosmos is not the universe. The cosmos is not nature. The cosmos is objectivity. Nature is a process. If you were able to reach to the still core inside nature and turn it inside out, you would have the cosmos. Just as if you were to reach into the objective actuality of the cosmos and find the dynamic which is there, even deeper than stillness, and turn the cosmos inside out, you would find nature. Towards the end of his life, Carl Jung was absolutely convinced. His last book that he was reading was Teilhard de Chardin's The Phenomenon of Man. We know because the Chilean ambassador at that time, Miguel Serrano, went to visit Jung. He was 86, 2 days before Jung died. Serrano said that Jung had let his hair go so that it was white, spiky hair, underneath a kind of a conical hat, like a wizard's hat. Incidentally, the origin of that wizard's hat is from the Mevlevi dervishes. But not just the Mevlevi dervishes. Before that, it was the sign of the ancient Iranian astronomers, who coordinated their person with the cosmos. They watched stars and made constellations. Chaldean scientists invented astronomy about 5,000 years ago. Why? Because they wanted to keep track of an objective form that was related to them. The person is related to the cosmos very directly, just like the body and the mind are related. In fact, they consider each other identical. Just so the spiritual person considers the cosmos such close kin that they're probably at least twin brothers, if not brother and sister, if not identical. The conical hat was first worn in the West by a Scotsman, oddly enough, whose name was Michael Scott, who was the mathematician to Friedrich Hohenstaufen back in the 12th century. And he was the first Westerner to wear the conical hat of the esoteric astronomer who understood that alchemy led to the transformation of body and mind out of the integral cycle into the gold of the person and the goldenness of the cosmos. And so Jung, 2 days before he died, was stomping around with his white hair frizzed under this conical hat that had stars and crescent moons on it. Wouldn't you just know? And he had a pipe so stuffed with tobacco, because he was kind of infirm and he didn't want to stuff it more than once a day. So as he was puffing, big clouds of smoke with sparks in it were steaming out, and he had a long robe on. It looked just like a medieval magus. And he had Tyre de Chardin's Phenomenon of Man tucked under one arm, and he was stomping around the room, and he was saying, "It's amazing what can be known." Because Teilhard de Chardin had confirmed to him an interesting idea that Jung had had when he wrote his last great fantastic work called Mysterium Coniunctionis. In the German edition, it comes out in 3 volumes. In the English translation, they only translated the first two. They were so unbelieving and thought that he's getting too much into magic, he's getting too much into esoterica. So they published the 3rd volume, but in a completely different color and gave it a different author. They put his co-worker Marie-Louise von France's name on it. Oh, this is one of Marie-Louise von France's books. Well, yes, she made the translation, but it's Jung's book. She translated, Jung could read Latin just as well as she could, but Jung wanted to have another mind as precise as his, and Marie-Louise von France, very precise, extraordinarily precise. If you want to understand Jung, she understood Jung. She translated the deathbed treatise of Thomas Aquinas. Now, Jung already was in trouble with church structures for having brought in all kinds of interesting things into play. He didn't want to come out and say that the doctor of the church, Thomas Aquinas, is the philosophic basis of the whole Roman Catholic Church. His Summa Theologica is the Principia Mathematica of Catholic theology. On his deathbed, he wrote an alchemical vision which completely takes away the structure and understanding of the Summa Theologica. It doesn't just pull the rug out, it removes the floor and the earth. And in the introduction to the 3rd volume of Mysterium Coniunctionis, translated into English as Aurora Consurgens, Jung observes that it's quite possible in an Einsteinian Minkowski universe, Bloch universe, to have as the ultimate set of reality in the deepest part of the unconscious, the collective unconscious, of not only a person who has their personality, their persona, their ego, their self, their unconscious, the personal unconscious, but the collective unconscious of which they are in access to, that if one went to the farthest reaches of the collective unconscious, one would come out at the edge of the known universe. And that if you went out to the edge of the known universe, to the edge of stuff, one would come to a threshold where one would enter into the deepest part of the collective unconscious. In other words, that we and the cosmos form an infinite mathematical torus. That we are not separate polarities whatsoever. We're not infinitesimal specks in face of a monstrous enormity. It's that that monstrous enormity, so-called, is the base upon which we are real. And that our reality is the only guarantee that that so-called monstrous enormity is real at all. And that one of the great discoveries of Jung, of Rumi, of every man and woman who's become conscious to some nth degree, is that the whole fate of reality depends on whether we are real or not. As Gurdjieff said, titling his third book, which he didn't want published too often, "I am only real when I am." That this responsibility is not just to establish an ego or a beautiful body or a fantastic mind or even a gorgeous artistic person, but that the responsibility is to assure that reality itself occurs. And that only to the extent that some being does this, is it all still real? What would be the alternative? Lewis Carroll in Alice in Wonderland said in Metaphor, "We are all part of the same dream. Do not wake the sleeper." The converse of that is we are all part of the same reality. Do not fall asleep. What does our friend Schiller say about the person? Since we're talking about Schiller and Stravinsky, and now that the gloves are off, the fewer who show up, the more the gloves come off. It's your responsibility to understand this. I already have. I'm conveying to you the opportunity to do so. To the extent that you don't do so, to that extent you will not understand. Here's what Schiller writes, the 11th letter. "When abstraction rises to the highest level it can possibly attain, it arrives at two ultimate concepts before which it must halt and recognize that here it has reached its limits." What is abstraction? Abstraction is an objective quality of the mind. Abstraction is an integration that is so compact that it releases its referential necessity of connecting with nature. The mind discovers that it can abstract itself from the whole ecology that's nature-based. It can even abstract itself from the primary objectivity of the body. You can be abstracted from nature. You can be abstracted from the body. And then it discovers in the deepest power of abstraction, it can abstract itself from language. It can abstract itself from feeling-toned experience. In other words, it can abstract itself from myth, so that nature and ritual and myth are left in situ, and the mind abstracts itself into a purity of itself alone. And at that threshold discovers, Schiller says, two, a pair of concepts, a pair of ideas that form the polarizing limit of the abstraction process of the mind in and of itself. What are they? Of course, Schiller could be wrong. This was written 200 years ago. We must have made some advances since then. Well, perhaps not. The mind distinguishes in man something that endures and something that changes. Notice that the two concepts are a pair, one that endures, one that not only endures, but endures enduring, and one that changes, not only changes, but changes changing. Now, this is a very peculiar pair. This polarity is very peculiar. The first writing about this peculiar pair comes from a man who was an old white-haired philosopher when Socrates was a young man. The man's name was Parmenides. He was from this little tiny town in Greece called Elea. And he founded a whole school, the Eleatic philosophers, of whom his prize student was Zeno. Zeno, who is famous for all the paradoxes. Zeno, who was the first to state that there are paradoxes which the mind cannot solve. For instance, if you have point A and point B, and you only go halfway between A and B, and you continue to only go halfway, you will never arrive at B. Because you can always split the remaining difference, no matter how small, into half. Parmenides was famous for establishing that whole kind of paradoxical school, and he wrote a mystical poem called The Way of Truth. It's the only thing he left, other than this damned conundrum that minds couldn't get over. One of the most powerful and puzzling of all of Plato's dialogues is called the Parmenides. And if you can read the Parmenides, even with four or five commentaries, two pays off to you. It's very, very difficult. It's notorious. Parmenides, in his mystical poem, The Way of Truth, posed for the very first time in the Western tradition the idea that there are disjunctive polarities that never meet. He said, in essence, what is, and what isn't, isn't. And they never touch. They never, ever touch. That what is never can be confused with what isn't, and that what isn't an is. There is no thing as a what is not. Whereas what is never not is. What is always is, and what isn't always isn't. Now what Schiller is doing here is he's giving a romantic, transcendental spin to Parmenides' disjunctive polarity. He's saying that when the mind abstracts itself from nature, and then the mind abstracts itself from ritual bodies, and then abstracts itself from language, feeling-toned experience of the mythic level, and comes purely into the mind, purely into an abstract symbolic realm, the moment that it does that, it comes up against this paired limitation that what endures always endures and what changes always changes and never is. The difference between the Schiller formulation and Parmenides meant a complete null, a vacuum, a void. The ultimate development of the Greek void took place 800 years later in India. after the Greeks had carried these ideas to India. In India, they thought that they were really big yogic honchos because they could get down to the Atman. And then along came some Parmenide-trained Greeks and said, can you imagine erasing the Atman? What would that leave? And some Indian genius named Nagarjuna finally got, he said, it leaves zero. And after they shook his hand, they went away and they left India with the conundrum of what do you do with shunyata? That shunyata is related to tathata in a disjunctive way. They never touch. They never meet. That suchness and emptiness never, ever have any point in tangential identity. They have no identity whatsoever. So that the first thing that goes out the window is that the notion of identity is permanent. If it's impossible for identity to be ultimately there, then it certainly isn't permanent. What's permanent is that emptiness and suchness never touch. That what endures and what changes, while they do not touch, there must be some way in which they pair. But a polarized pair which does not touch can only come into mutual influence by a transformation. You have to transform out of the polarity. As long as you stay in the polarized mode, you're never going to get the laser-like truth. The oneness. You're always going to be in duality. But the oneness is possible if you transform. But you cannot transform the form. You can't transform suchness. You can't transform void. What you transform is the whole order in which they occur. You transform integration. And when you transform integration, what does it transform into? It transforms into differentiation. And for that, we have to study another 15 years. Let's take a break. Let's come back to Schiller. Let's come back to Schiller. Just to give us a little refreshing, we're talking about how the artistic person, how the objectivity of the person is not the same objectivity as a body, nor is it the same objectivity as a mind. The body and the mind, to be objective, are we okay? The body and the mind, to be objective, have to be integrated. But to the extent that a person is integrated, to that extent they are truncated. When you can identify yourself, you're wearing a mask. When you no longer care about identifying yourself, you've come a long way. When you contort yourself to measure up somebody's image of you so that you can fit that image, that's very nice on a tribal level, but it has no place in art whatsoever. So the artist, with characteristic panache, throws away as imprisoning the values which are inculcated on the ritual level and must do so. What makes it so pernicious in the historical process is that most very powerful social forms are still ritual determined forms that have nothing to do with the differential qualities of the person. And this is never so apparent as when the state tells you that you cannot do this, it's against the laws of the state. The tyranny of the state over the person is one of the most crucial conflicts in the historical process. In the ancient Jewish tradition, it was always put into the form that in order to find yourself, you have to go into an exile. You have to leave, you have to be the prodigal son. You have to leave the social form that's there. You have to leave the family, you have to leave the kingdom. You have to go. Otherwise, you're not able to even begin to be in the playing field where the person can emerge, because the person never emerges integrally, always emerges differentially, which means that the person is a play of possibility and not at all an identification. Ray Bradbury once said one of his favorite quotes was from Juan Ramon Jimenez when he received the Nobel Prize for Literature. If they give you ruled paper, turn it around and write the other way. Don't fill in their blanks. To the extent that you're busy filling in other people's blanks about you, you're not tending to your resonances, which is where you are real. And so, to the extent that the artist comes into play, to that extent, at least at the beginning, before you get used to it, you have to tear up the rules. They're their rules. Goethe and Beethoven were walking down a street in Germany one time, and who came along the street but Napoleon on his horse? And Goethe pulled on Beethoven to get up out of the street onto the sidewalk to let the little emperor pass. And Beethoven pulled on Goethe and said, "Let him get out of our way." In the 11th letter by Schiller, look at the kind of language he jumps to just a few paragraphs later. The person which manifests itself in the eternally persisting I, and only in this, cannot become, cannot have a beginning in time. You can point to the body and you can say, this body began with this particular conception. This egg, this sperm, there. That body began there, but the person has no beginning whatsoever. Time is irrelevant to a differential form. What time is it in the cosmos? Is it Friday afternoon in the galaxy? It's ridiculous. It has no bearing whatsoever. The same is true of space, because time and space are related. What's up in interstellar space? Robert Heinlein wrote a beautiful story when I was born called Waldo. It's about a weak, fat man who has this home 25,000 miles up in orbit. Everyone else calls it wheelchair for the cripple. He calls it freehold for his own individuality. And because it's gravityless, because then he's very strong with no gravity, everything just floats. There's no up or down. And he does very well in this suspended potpourri of stuff. He's happy there. Schiller. The person which manifests itself in the eternally persisting I, and only in this, cannot become, cannot have a beginning in time. The reverse is rather the case. Time must have its beginning in the person. Since something constant must form the basis of change, for change to take place, there must be something which changes. This something cannot therefore itself be change. If we say the flower blooms and fades, we make the flower the constant in this transformation and endow it, as it were, with a person in which these two conditions become manifest. A few paragraphs later, here's how he's now talking. His personality, considered for itself alone and independently of all sense material, is merely the predisposition to a possible expression of his infinite nature. This is an English translation. The German is much more compacted. His personality, the artist's personality, considered for itself alone and independently of all sense material, is the predisposition to a possible expression of his infinite nature. The cosmos is an objective resonance of that infinite differential. The cosmos is not objectively there, someplace where you could triangulate with a ruler. It's there is not an integral there. It's not locatable in space. It's not locatable in time. Not even in time-space, it's not locatable because it's not of a locatable objectivity. It's of a possible objectivity. The person, the artist, is possible. The cosmos, in the same way, is always possible. The ego, being an integral form, never understands this. And the mind, being an integral form, understands it but never believes it. And the poor burrow of a person who's not devious enough to have an ego, nor trained enough to have a mind, doesn't even suspect that such could be real. Or even possible. Would not know it if it met it in the garden. A spiritual person, purely spiritual, walking in a garden, filled with people who are unable to even beginningly differentiate, simply would not see, would not recognize that there was anyone there. Like the eyewitness, the Gospel of John, that after the resurrection, Jesus is standing there in the garden and no one sees him. Except one person. When she stopped weeping for the death of the body, for the passing of the brilliant mind, when she started to tune herself to the differential openness, then she saw someone standing there, but didn't recognize because wasn't fine-tuned enough to see the face, just the figure. She thought it was the gardener who asked her, "Why are you crying?" She said, "They've taken his body and hidden it, and I don't know where. That's why I'm crying. And the only person there with Mary Magdalene was young Saint John. He was about 13 years old. And he heard it. That's why he was able to be an eyewitness. He was the only person that heard it. So then he calls her name, Mary. Then she could see him. Because it was the differential name that focused her spiritual person enough that she could see the cosmic being right there and recognize Rabbi. It's as simple, it's as magical, it's as mystical as that. But it doesn't happen for them way back when and only there. It happens every single time a spiritual person emerges out of ignorance and is. The oceanic applause from a cosmos of appreciation is overwhelming. Why not? Because only then is the cosmos also real, because its possibility is activated. It's not there as an identifiable place, focus in time, space. It's there with the infinite resonances of every possibility. Differential forms are quite extraordinarily different. Here, 200 years ago, is Schiller, who not only writes this series of letters to a would-be student, he's not just writing these letters to someone who probably couldn't even read these completely. Who is Schiller's main correspondent in his life? Goethe. The correspondence between Schiller and Goethe are collected into two huge volumes because they wrote to each other all the time. Goethe was like his twin resonance brother. Whenever Schiller would start to get physically ill because he was physically very brittle, he died in his 40s. Goethe would make sure that he had a position someplace. He finally got Schiller a position in Weimar, where Goethe was the reigning wise man, just so Schiller could have a place to be. It's in the correspondence of Schiller and Goethe that you find Schiller refining the art of letter writing. He not only could write fantastic plays and fantastic poetry, he wrote poems like the Hymn to Freedom that Beethoven set to music, the Ninth Symphony. But he could write philosophy. He could write all three, plays, poetry, and philosophy, but he learned a fourth form with Goethe. He learned the art of letter writing. So Schiller's letters turn out to be one of the very high artistic forms because letter writing is a development of the dialogue, the Platonic dialogue, the Hermetic dialogues. The form of Plato's dialogues is exactly the same form as Greek tragedy, only where Greek tragedy is the denouement, the realization of the form that has led to it, the tragedy. It's the negative solution to Maxwell's field equation. The purpose of a Greek tragedy is to realize that you misunderstood all of it. You misunderstood who you were. You misunderstood who human beings are. You misunderstood who the gods are, what reality is, and that you have no idea. And that's the tragedy. That there's no one who knows that you could go and ask. The realization is that all of this is pride. All of this is hubris. Do you think on some sophomoric level that Sophocles is eternally great because Oedipus realizes that he made a mistake and married his mother? That's sophomoric. That's actually nothing compared to the tragic realization that you have misunderstood permanently what is true and real and have no way to find out. That human nature is cracked in a universe that's cracked exactly with the same flaw, that it's not discoverable in any integral identity way. That what's true, ultimately, is a resonance of mystery and has no way to be coordinated. This is tragic. And that your whole sense of identity is all based, is all firm, is all stable on being able to identify. And that all of that is riding on sand with the incoming tide. That has no bearing whatsoever. What time is it in the universe? What's up 500,000 light years away from here? It's not only who knows, it's that it's irrelevant. So that Greek tragedy is like the negative solution, whereas Plato's dialogues are the positive solution of the same formula, the same equations. Plato's dialogues show that it is not possible to understand anything whatsoever with the mind in its integral mode, but that one can transform the mind, transform yourself out of that mode into a different mode, into the differential. You can become conscious. And that in terms of conscious time-space, there you can understand. But you have to understand not in an integral way, but in a differential way. You have to understand possibility and not identity. One of Wallace Stevens' most beautiful poems ends with the couplet phrasing, "They said the good man has no face, as if they knew." Once, when he was very old, St. John was in Ephesus, and he came into this home. All the late first century Christian gatherings were always in homes. And he saw this painting of a person's head on the wall, in where the sleeping quarters were. And he called in the man and woman of the house, and he gestured to it. He said, "What is this?" John was at that time in his late 80s. He said, "You know, we have no graven images." They said, "But Master, it's you. It's a portrait of you." And the woman of the house went over and took the wash basin and set it down when the water stilled. St. John was able to look in and see the reflection of himself. He smiled. And he blessed them and he said, "That's not me. It has nothing to do with me. This is not me. The painting is not me. The reflection in the water is not me. And this isn't me." Fortunately, they were able to get it. This limiting integral in time-space is of only passing reference of one possibility of what I really am. What am I? Infinite possibilities without end. How does the early prayer sequence go? God gives blessing to us, world without end. It's a differential form of saying. Schiller writes, "As long as he merely feels, as long as the personality merely feels, merely desires, and acts upon mere desire, He is as yet nothing but world. But if by this term we understand nothing but the formless content of time, it's nothing but the formless content of time. You have to go a little deeper here. It's an old Hermetic thing. Time has forms as well as space. Space forms are geometric cutouts, but time forms are like phase cutouts. True, writes Schiller, true, it is his sensuous nature alone which can turn this potential into actual power. But it is only his personality which makes all his activity into something which is inalienably his own. In order, therefore, not to be mere world, he must impart form to matter. In order not to be mere form, he must give reality to the predisposition he carries within him. He gives reality to form when he brings time into being, when he confronts changelessness with change, the eternal unity of his own self with the manifold variety of the world. He gives form to matter when he annuls time again, when he affirms persistence within change, and subjugates the manifold variety of the world to the unity of his own self. Now, these are fighting words. And they were meant to be fighting words 200 years ago. What was the situation? The hope of the world, the French Revolution, had gone sour. Instead of opening up human freedom, it brought in the terror. People were bringing children and wives and friends to eat the sandwiches and the salami while the guillotine was beheading anybody who was accused of any difference from the mob. If you're not of us, then you will die. Schiller was saying, is this the hope of the world? That we are mulched into a mobocracy, a mediocrity that keeps sinking into bestiality? Is this the future? Absolutely not. And so these letters are written over there to that guy in order to be sounded throughout the world. Anyone who reads this, these letters are written to you. But you, in order to read them, have to be there to receive them. And one of the difficulties of the 20th century is that this is no longer fashionable nor possible either. So that here is the compliment to Schiller, Stravinsky, Poetics of Music, the third lecture. How does 150 years later Stravinsky characterize the scene? He understands Schiller very well. We are living at a time when the status of man is undergoing profound upheavals. Modern man is progressively losing his understanding of values and his sense of proportions. This is 1939. This failure to understand essential realities is extremely serious. It leads us infallibly to the violation of the fundamental laws of human equilibrium. In the domain of music, the consequences of this misunderstanding are these. On the one hand, there's a tendency to turn the mind away from what I shall call the higher mathematics of music in order to degrade music to servile employment and to vulgarize it by adapting it to the requirements of an elementary utilitarianism. French Revolution mob time. He says, an example of this is Soviet music. On Stalinist state music. On the other hand, since the mind itself is ailing, the music of our time, and particularly the music that calls itself and believes itself pure, carries within it the symptoms of a pathological blemish and spreads the germs of a new original sin. The old original sin was chiefly a sin of knowledge. The new original sin, if I may speak in these terms, is first and foremost a sin of non-acknowledgement. And this kind of feigned indifference, this kind of inculcated neutrality has nothing to do with balance. Also has nothing to do with shunyata. Nothing to do with void. Nothing to do with emptiness. Emptiness is cool. Of indifference, Dante reserved the hottest spots in hell for those who are indifferent in a time of moral crisis. It's this insanity that makes our world a junkyard. It is unspeakably vulgar. It is incomprehensibly ignorant. But the most leveling criticism that one can bring to it is that it is not real. Almost nothing that engages your attention is real. It's all a provisional make-do by third-graders with fourth-grade educations that are hopelessly out of date. They were out of date 200 years ago. They were out of date 2,500 years ago. They're already out of date. It's nothing to do with anything. Is it any wonder, then, that someone poignant like a Samuel Beckett would write the kind of plays that he wrote? That one gets to a neutered, dead-even limbo, and that's the best that one can hope for under conditions that are ceaselessly changing and remaining exactly the same. You may have any shade of gray that you wish, but there is no black and there's no white, and especially then, there is no color. The world to a spiritual eye looks exactly as if some volcanic ash had settled over the color of the world and had turned it a very uninteresting gray. And that's about where it is, 1997. It's a volcanic ash world. And the best figures who stand out are those cinder stick-like mobilities, because they do stand out against gray. But of human beings who are colorful in a world of life, one doesn't see much. One doesn't see much at all. We're going to end here with art. Next week, we have an interval. And then the following week, we begin the most perilous of all the sessions. That's 12 weeks on history. And history is very formidable. But in the interval, in order to give us a breather, to give us not only a space, but a conscious space, next week we're going to talk about one of the greatest poets who ever lived, who was able to see the world of real people in all of its color, and able to understand that the gray tapestry of identity had nothing whatsoever to do with the differential realities of a spiritual person whose heart was completely alert. And that poet was Emily Dickinson. And almost as if to make a point, she rarely left the little town of Amherst, Massachusetts, physically, but she almost never was just there. And we'll talk about that next week. She was never, incidentally, published during her lifetime. Just a few of her poems were read by a couple of people. And it was only later, when her poems were collected and put out, that almost every conscious person in the literate world today recognizes this incredibly unique voice. Like Sappho was a voice of sensuous bodily awareness, Emily Dickinson was the feminine voice of the spiritual person alive. Thank you.